Blog Talk Radio. Sharon Schutz, coming to you live with my friends and my co-anchors, Michael Schutz and David. Once again, I'm very, very cautious about messing your last name up. So I'm going to let you introduce yourself, but welcome to the show. We have a wonderful show planned for us tonight. We have Shoa Zilch. She was raised as a Muslim as a little girl, grew up, was given her hand in marriage. An arranged marriage, and she's had a very unusual life, and she's turned her life over to God, and God has done a lot of miracles for her. And she's going to tell us her story and what all he has done. And he's done some amazing things. I've known this woman for 2 or 3 years myself, and I've just really watched what God's doing just in the last couple of years. And he's just doing an amazing things in her life. We have some special guests that are supposed to call in. And we welcome you. Everybody that's here tonight, we just know that God has brought you to this place. Nobody's here by accident, and we just thank you for being here. So, David, tell us how your week went, and tell everybody your last name.
All righty. Why don't we start with that? I'm David DiCrescenzo. It's pronounced just exactly as it's spelled. And I had a wonderful week. I've got a lot of different things done. I'm very busy when I'm not on the radio or writing articles for the Patriots Press. I keep myself otherwise working and busy. So I've had a busy week. I do, if you can probably tell from my voice tonight, I have a little bit of a cold that is just starting to grow and take residence in my chest. But that's okay. I'm taking all the over-the-counter meds that I can. I'm very much looking forward to this show. As many of our listeners will remember, about 3 weeks or so ago, while I was up in South Carolina with Wild Bill and Tom Trento and Damon and Mark and a bunch of those other people, Don Brown, we had Shoa on, for the last segment of the show. And I knew from the moment she started, within about a minute, that that wasn't even going to barely be enough to scratch the surface. So I'm very excited that she has agreed to take the time this evening to take the entire show and just explain her story of what life was like growing up in that environment, what she went through, how she got to where she is, and her success in life thus far. So I think it's going to be awesome. And I know that our listeners are excited to hear the story as well. And with that long introduction of myself, I'd like to say good evening to both Dr. Sharon and Shoa, and I'd like Mike to chime in and introduce himself, if he would. Michael, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm the other half of Sharon, and been that way for so long, I don't remember when it started, but it's like I don't have a past without her. So we're excited about being here tonight, and I just excited about Shoa being here because she is such a good speaker and she has such a good grasp of this subject. And we as Americans, this is new to us. And I'm just looking forward to getting the exposure that's necessary so we can look forward to the future and see what might be in store for us.
There you go. Well, why don't we do this then, if I may? We've all introduced ourselves briefly. Dr. Sharon and Mike and myself, what I'd like to do is I would like to once again introduce our special guest to our audience. I would like her to introduce herself even after what Dr. Sharon has said. Shoa, why don't you say hello to the folks and just basically tell us a little bit about yourself, and you can really pretty much have the run of the show for the next 5 or 10 minutes, or as long as you might want. We're going to be getting some callers in, and they'll be asking questions. And I'm sure that myself or Sharon or Mike will have to interrupt here and there and ask a question or two. But Shoa, I'm handing you the microphone right now. It's yours.
Well, thank you so much for having me tonight. I'm excited. I'm not nervous, but I'm excited. And
there's nothing to be nervous about at all. As I said earlier, just pretend that you're sitting at a coffee table having tea, which, as you told me, you actually are. So just run with that. You'll be good.
Yes. Well, my name is Sheila Zilt, and I live here in a little town in Texas. And I met Sharon a few years ago. And I think I have a story inside me that's just bubbling to get out. And it's been bubbling to get out for a while. I just didn't know it until people started asking me questions. And I didn't realize the treasure I had until, you know, it started coming out. And, you know, my husband will be one to tell you that as a Muslim, you know, women barely speak above a whisper. So to be able to speak, to be speaking on air, you know, to be having a radio, to be doing a radio interview is beyond the scope of my wildest imagination. I can't even begin to think that this is where I would be someday. And so I'm very honored that God has brought me and he's using me to give my testimony about my Christian conversion. This environment that women live in, that Muslims live in, I don't even call it a religion anymore, but this phenomena that is Islam, that people can make something really good out of it, that women that do come out of living under Islam's oppression can use it to draw other women out, not just Muslims, certainly Muslims, but also other women. So it is an amazing platform that God used to launch me. you know, just to tell women that how God can transform you. He not only changes you, Scripture says he makes you new, and he can transform you and use you to bring so many people out, you know, so many women out of this this phenomena that is Islam, this cult that is Islam. So I am very honored to be able to do that. And it's really a journey of discovery. A lot of times when women come out of the abuse and religious persecution, it's like when you're in it, it is like a circular pen where they have penned you in, and it is religious persecution. It is religious spiritual oppression. It is, in my case, my family can actually trace their roots back 2,000 years to Muhammad. So I have 2,000 years of strongholds in my life, you know, I've had to break. And only Jesus can do that. And only he has been able to take me beyond that. And, you know, instead of being bitter, and instead of using it as a crutch to get what I want, or, you know, I mean, to use it as a crutch for maybe not succeeding, not trying hard enough, instead to use it as a testimony of how far I've come.
Sheila, let me ask you a question, if I can interrupt you for a quick second. Yes. I told you that we would probably have a couple of special guests that I'd like you to meet. And we're very honored and blessed to have a very special caller on line four right now. His name is Kelly Cook. He is the executive director for Act for America, and I believe that's his title. And please correct me if I'm wrong, Kelly, when you come on. But I would like to introduce both of you to each other, and I'm going to put Kelly on right now so that he can say hello to you, Shoah. So here we go. Kelly.
Hey, thanks.
I'd like you to
thanks
show
so
her
much,
and
David.
Show her. This is Kelly. You're welcome.
Thanks so
Hi,
much.
Hi, Kelly. How are you doing?
It's great to meet you. David, yeah, my actual title is National Field Director. I oversee chapter development around the world on our project. And Shoa, your story is sounding fascinating already.
Well, it's interesting, for sure.
Yeah, wow. I would dare say. Why don't we do this? Because I'm not sure if Shoa is 100% on board with what Act for America does. Kelly, could you just explain in sort of a nutshell to Shoa and to some of
sure.
our listeners who may not be familiar exactly what your work is, what Act for America does?
Sure. Act for America was founded by Brigitte Gabriel, and she was Christian Maronite growing up in Lebanon in the mid-1970s. She was 10 years old when her family home was bombed by Hezbollah, and it literally destroyed the home, and she and her parents were left under the rubble of the damage, and they were able to dig her out and her parents, and she literally lived in a bomb shelter for 7 years, her entire teenage years, in the late 70s and early 80s in southern Lebanon before they could move down into northern Israel, where they had much more support and shelter. And she ended up being an anchor for the Middle East news there out of Jerusalem, and began her journalism career, and married her husband there, and they moved to the U.S., later on, and she's formed Act for America, and it's basically, she says that, look, she's already lost one country of her birth, Lebanon, to this threat, and she is doing everything she can to protect America from having the same fate, and it's a ministry, and, you know, for the Christian world, our response to Muslims are literally twofold. And I kind of liken it, you know, in the day after the Super Bowl, I liken it to a football team. And that is, half the team plays offense and half the team plays defense. And in this analogy, when we play offense with the Muslim world, we're bringing them the good news of the gospel and what Jesus can do for them. Now, that's not what Act for America does, but we work very closely with churches, parachurch, and mission organizations who are doing that amazing work. Act for America's focus is on playing defense, and that's educating America and the West to the fact that the minority that is driving the bus really does want to kill us, and it's warning us to wisen up, be very shrewd when we, you know, this deal with Iran is a deal with the devil, and to really go out of our way to protect the West from this threat. So every once in a while, the two sides of the football team really ought to get together and get to know each other.
So now would be a good time probably for a show with us. Tell everybody a little bit about maybe, you know, where she comes from. She was born in India and raised in Venezuela,
yes,
and moved to the United States when you were 18.
Yes.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay. I was born in Calcutta, India, and my parents went to Venezuela. My dad was an electrical engineer there, and I lived there for 18 years. Now, back then, that was back in the late 70s, mid-80s, Venezuela, you know, the dollar was just at $4.30, so the economy was very strong under Carlos Andrés Pérez, and it was great. And then I came here, I came to study, and, in the traditional Indian, I was raised. My dad is a Sunni Muslim, and my mom is a Shiite Muslim. So I grew up with both of those factions of Islam. And they were very traditional as far as I couldn't, you know, go out. I couldn't have any girlfriends or boyfriends. It was, we just pretty much stayed at home. But I did come here to study, and that was my understanding, was that I had come here to study, but what my mom really wanted within the few weeks that I had come here for my orientation was that she met a family in the mosque over here, and you know, within about 2 weeks, I was engaged to a man from Pakistan. And January of 91, I was married to him. I was 18 and he was 30 years old. So, you know, it was a big difference. But not only that, what we didn't know is that he was a very fundamentalist Shiite Muslim. So he was very pro-Iranian. He is a Sayyid, which if you understand Islamic terminology, would make him an elite Muslim, and that in itself carries a greater responsibility to propagate Islamic agenda. And he was very pro Hezbollah, So, you know, at the age of 18, I started getting these lectures of what Hezbollah was and how evil the West is and America is the great Satan. I had never heard any of this, but, I mean, that's who he was, you know. He's already a seasoned Muslim, 30 years old,
you said he was no longer?
He still is. He absolutely is. In fact, he is in jail right now. The FBI has arrested him because for making terroristic threats. So he is in jail. Yes. But I'm just saying that, you know, that's how my married life started. And it was, I had a very rude awakening to married life. I had to learn really fast what it was to live in a strict Muslim home. You know, before I got married, I wouldn't wear the hijab or the scarf or anything, but as soon as I got married, yes, that was the first gift that he gave me a dark, you know, a black, an abaya is what you call it, and the black burqa to wear, and I wasn't allowed to, you know, he would get mad if I would show my feet, you know, if he could see my feet or my hands or anything. I mean, I just couldn't, and I had to adjust to that really fast.
Shoa, this is Kelly. A question for you. Did you give your consent to marry him, or was it forced upon you?
Well, when you grow up knowing that is your choice, and, you know, Islam, it's not like over here where you have your religion, which is Christianity or whatever religion you have, and then you have your family life and your individual identity. With Islam, with living in a traditional Indian household, your religion, your parents, your perception, how people perceive you, you know, your reputation, it all comes in one package. So, you know, you go against any one of these any one of those standards, and you, you know, you're just going to bring down the building. So you can't do any of that. So I didn't know I had a choice. I mean, I grew up here in the West. I grew up in Venezuela, but I didn't know I had a choice to say no.
You moved here because you were going to go to school. You were going to go to Rice University.
Yes.
Didn't you have a scholarship to Rice University?
Yes, I did.
And after you got here, that was discouraged? Or
well, he didn't let me go. No.
Okay.
After I got married, he said, no, I cannot.
And at 18 years old, you're still a child in a lot of ways.
Well, not to him. You know, when I turned 20, mm-hmm. he said, well, in our culture, you know, when a woman is 20, that's when she's over the hill. So now I have to go find another wife. So, you know, that's the general mentality, mm-hmm. and that was certainly his. That's what I used to have to hear. Anything I did wrong, you know, in the Muslim culture, you marry. I think it's more in the Indian Pakistani culture. When you get married to the husband, you marry the whole family. And the younger you are, so if you're the wife of the oldest son, you might have a few rights. But I was the wife of the youngest son, so I didn't have any. So, you know, my husband could tell me what to do. My mother-in-law could tell me what to do. The children of my brother-in-law could tell me what to do. You know, I was right at the bottom of the totem pole.
Kind of a pecking order?
Yes, absolutely. And you just have to learn. You know, you learn your place, and you have to learn it quickly because it's ruthless. My mother-in-law, you know, she would tell me, many times, of course, I was 18, and, you know, I would fight with him, and then I'd go and sit and cry, and she would tell me, you need to understand, and she was genuine. She really tried for me to fit into her family, and that is why they like the younger girls, because it is easier to mold them, you know, into mm-hmm. your family system, into your family dynamics. And she would tell me, you know, your husband is not your friend. He is your master. He is your owner. You need to don't look at him as your friend, and life will be easier for you. Growing up, my mom, she would tell me, you know, we learn how to cook and sew and do everything. And you always prepare the daughter for her future life, you know, her future married life. And she would tell me that, no, Shoa, this is not your home. Your home will be when you get married to your husband. That will be your home. Well, when I got married, my mother-in-law said, this is not your home. This is your husband's house and your children's house, and you are here. Your responsibility is to take care of it. So this is what, you know, Muslim women face. This is what they have. They can't, there is no going back. You know, they really don't have a home to go back to. And the home that they live in, they have to walk on eggshells because at any time, you know, he can bring in another wife or... You know, it just depends how traditional your family is. And, you know, they can send you, they can kick you out of the house and you end up in a shelter or you end up in a house for prostitutes or on the street. There is no structure.
So you have no rights at all?
No, we don't.
You have no rights
Absolutely.
At all? Did you and your first husband, did you ever find yourselves in the United States together, or was that ended before you came here?
Oh, I got married here in the United States.
They lived in Houston.
Okay.
I got married in Houston, and I was married to him for 17 years.
So it didn't matter the fact that you were in the United States. You still had to live under those rules established by by Islam, basically.
Absolutely, it's a whole other world. You know, there is the what we call the white people world, and then there is the Muslim household where you are. You know, and a lot of Muslims, a lot of these Indian men, especially in Pakistanis, you know, they're well-educated, so they make a lot of money. They have these beautiful, I used to have a beautiful six-bedroom, 6,000-square-foot home, but you're confined to it. And
it's prison.
You, yes, and you cannot leave anywhere without telling him. You cannot leave the house without a son. So, you know, of course, many, you know, of course, sons are, you know, loved on, and, you know, they're, it's wonderful that you have lots of sons because, of course, they produce, you know, they're money makers, but also because they are part of the chaperone system for the woman. That is the only way that she can actually get out of the house, is to have a son accompany her. It doesn't matter if the son is 4 years old. As long as she has her son along with her, her modesty, her purity is safe. So it is a culture. You know, the biggest thing is that it's a culture of shame. So the husband is, according to the traditions of the Prophet, the Hadith of Prophet Muhammad, it is that the husband is, there is only one God, but in this world, in the fleshly world, I guess, I don't even know how to say it, but your husband is your God. So it's not like I worship him, but I have to treat him as good as I would treat my God, as I would respect him. So if I did,
you know, this is Kelly. I'd like to break in. You know what's so ironic to me is that politically, the radical feminists in the United States are much more closely aligned with this ideology than they are with you know, traditional American values. It's just unbelievable to me that they would preach against all these so-called abuses against women from the conservative right when they're perfectly willing to climb into bed politically with Islamists. I mean, it is the
exactly.
ultimate of irony.
Well, it's
I don't
exactly,
understand it.
I was just going to say the same thing with Hillary Clinton. I mean, here she is, you know, she's kissing up to them left and right politically, and she claims to be all for women. At the same time, it's like she supports people that would treat women the way Sheryl was treated and so many other women that are affected that way. And Kelly, you could probably spend the rest of the show discussing people that you've met and know that have gone through that sort of thing. I'm sure of it.
Well, you know, we, from time to time, we are introduced to a Muslim woman who is trying to leave the system, leave the family, and especially for the sake of her children, because many times a Muslim husband will marry an American wife and procreate, have children, and then when they're at a certain age, it's time for them to go on summer vacation back to the Middle East, and many times the wife never sees them again. And so we're getting desperate calls from these women who have figured out what's about to happen and saying, hey, we need a safe home. We need a place for me and my children to escape. So it's very, very dire.
Yes, it is. I can't even explain to you the humiliation I had to go through, that I chose to go through to be able to get out of the divorce, to get a divorce from him, because he didn't, you know, well, I guess I'm getting ahead of myself because I haven't talked about, you know, how my divorce is, but I essentially had to trick my husband into giving me a Muslim divorce. Not just an American court divorce, but a Muslim certificate of divorce if I ever wanted to get married again. Because that's almost impossible.
Let me ask a question about that, Shoa. It's my understanding, I've been told this many times, that if your husband had wanted to divorce you, any Muslim man wants to divorce a woman, he simply says, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, and it's a done deal. Is that correct, first of all?
That is correct for the Sunni faction. It is not correct for the Shiite faction. The Shiite faction actually has to go, it depends which imam you follow, because there are certain heads of the schools of thought. So you can choose to follow one and choose to follow another. And in my case, we had to have some counseling and some witnesses and a valid reason to do so. So it's not, it was generally for the Shiite, no, it is not. You cannot do it that way.
So you basically had to go about getting your divorce American way.
Yes, I am. Yes. I guess a long story short, you know, there was a lot of physical abuse. He would, anytime I did something that he didn't like, whether I have six biological children, and I was pregnant a lot. So, you know, it didn't matter if I was pregnant or not. He would throw me out of the house and just lock the door. He would physically move me out of the house. And lock the door. And then he would proceed to tell the children, you know, what a bad mother I am, what a failure I am, and all kinds of things. The reason, you know, after 9/11, when I watched him celebrate while I was sitting and crying, things just really moved fast. For him, as far as being, I think he recognized that he had to make an active choice as to which side he was going to take. He decided he was going to take the radical Muslim fundamentalist side of things. So we started having meetings in our house with other Muslims, you know. And my children were being part of it. They were having to listen to radical, you know, terroristic ideas and discussions. And I didn't like that. I started certainly questioning my religion. I started questioning God. I was not a Christian by any means. But I just, you know, I was such a good Muslim for so long. And when that wall started coming out, when all those, you know, they started falling, I went to probably about a 6 months of a nervous breakdown. I really, I would just cry all day because I knew that eventually I would have to leave this. And leaving all of that meant I would have to give up on, you know, my family. And my family would have to give up on give me.
You know, I have to say, Cheryl, what you just said about, you know, your world falling apart and the walls coming down and things like that, it reminds me very much of, they've made a song of it that I've heard, but it's, and I think it's very true in your case, your world wasn't falling apart, it was falling into place. And having said that, just then, while you contemplate that, I do want to remind all of our listeners, if you'd like to call in and speak with Shoa, or Kelly, or any one of us, the call-in number, I forgot to mention it earlier, is area code 929-477-1441. And, of course, I'll repeat that. It's 929-477-1441. Getting back to what I just said, though, have you heard that expression before, Shoa, about your world not falling apart, just simply falling into
Absolutely.
Place? I think that really... That's so true for so many people. We think that things are crumbling, but that's just what the Lord wants sometimes. Because sometimes you have to get down a base to move ahead. And from what I know of you, you've certainly you've come so far, and you've still got so far to go. I get the sense that the Lord is just beginning with your story. I wanted to just
Absolutely,
throw that in there.
David. He's had to. You know, he's had to break it all down. He's had to break it completely and not leave any trace of anything that can hold me back. in order to make me a new person. So it's not always easy. I certainly didn't see it when it was happening then, but I see the process now, and now I understand it. But it was very difficult, and it was hard because not only did I go against my parents, who loved me in their own way. You know, your parents love you even though they're strict and everything. I went against my children had to watch, and some of them were in their teens, so they had to watch their mother, and they had to trust their mother even though she was acting absolutely loony, according to the Muslim standards. And it was very hard. I think that it's sad to say the abuse was so bad that they didn't ever ask to go back. We left in the middle of the night one night, and we went to the women's shelter. I went to my parents' house, but in about 2 days, my parents really asked me to leave because they couldn't be any part of it. They didn't want anyone to know that they were encouraging me to leave my husband in any way.
Hey, Shoah, I want to interrupt you for a quick second. I have a caller on hold right now. And what I'd like to do is, Kelly, you may remember this guy, but I want to introduce you to him, Shoah. He's, I consider him, he's a good friend of mine. He's pretty much a famous guy these days. He makes a lot of videos, and he discusses issues like this and whatever his topic of the day might be. He's one of the bravest guys I know because I think he's painted probably the biggest target on his back of anybody that I know, myself included. And he's a guy that people are going to be hearing a lot more about even still in the coming months. Without saying another word, I'd like to introduce you to Wild Bill for America. And Bill, I'd like you to say hello to Shoah and our audience. And Kelly, I know you've met, so please, I'm going to bring Bill on right now. Bill, you are live. Go ahead, buddy.
Maybe. David. Hello.
Yes, there you
are. Are you there?
Yes. Hello. How are you?
Hey, thank you for coming on and telling your story. I am very impressed. And I am very concerned about all the young women who are in the USA who are stuck in the same situation that you were in. And Kelly is absolutely right. We need to provide a way for them to escape, and we really can't trust the modern left-wing government to do anything that might irritate the Muslims. So I'm interested in what you think we as American Christians could do to offer hope for the young women who are trapped in these terrible situations.
Well, what I can say is we need to have more women that are willing to speak up about abuse,
yes,
up about Islam. And I think that in the beginning, I didn't condemn all of Islam. I had initially started breaking it down a little at a time, and that is okay too. Just to admit, just to take that first step and admit, okay, the way I'm being treated is not right. And Muslims, they're very spiritual, and they want to believe in God. And just to raise that question that there is, a true God, a loving God, which is something that Muslims do not have a comprehension of a loving God. They see God as a strict master. They certainly do not address him as a father. So just to understand that, the true God would never, never want to make anyone miserable or to debase a woman or a child just because she is a woman and she does, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make any rational sense. And just to even if we can just start with that, that is a big stronghold that will be coming down.
Well, hey, let me weigh in on that. let me weigh in on that issue as well. Bill, it's an honor to have you on the show. We obviously surely admire your work and the stands that you take, and I appreciate your love for ACT for America and Brigitte Gabriel and what we do. And you know, there's a micro picture here and a macro picture. The micro picture is the individual lives that are being decimated by this problem. And we have to, in Christian love, reach out to them one by one by one and rescue them from this travesty. The macro picture is, here's the facts. We have studied and found over 152 appellate-level cases in the United States where Sharia law was used in favor of an individual, usually against the rights of a wife in a Muslim family, 150 times in the last few years at the appellate level, which means there are thousands of cases that never got to the appellate level.
Yeah.
Where Sharia law was ruled in favor over against the woman's constitutional rights of living in the United States. So that's why ACT for America, we've been pushing American law for American courts legislation, and we've got that passed in 12 different states so far, and this prohibits any foreign law from being used to run roughshod over a citizen's constitutional rights. So we've got to hit this from both angles, helping the individual, but also changing the law so it can't happen, or it's illegal and they go to jail if they do allow it to happen.
Oh, I firmly agree that the laws need to be strengthened and enforced, you know, for anti-Sharia laws. But I'm concerned, Kelly, about the young women who are suffering now. Like Shona said, they need to speak out, but they're not going to be able to speak out until they know that they and their children will be safe, that they will have a
Absolutely.
Safe place that they can go to. And I see Christian churches of America as having a duty to offer that kind of sanctuary to young ladies who desperately need to get out of these situations. So, while
it's happening. It's happening all over the country on a kind of a patchwork basis.
Yeah.
Any church that I know of, that if they became aware of a situation like this, they would move heaven and earth to provide protection for that woman. And I know of several safe houses around the country that we would be happy to refer women to who might be hearing this and saying, wow, is there really an escape hatch for me? There absolutely is. It's there.
When Shoa first left her husband, she was in a shelter. And she's remarried now. She lives in a small town in far away. In fact, he even got arrested for coming here. He was going to hurt you, wasn't he?
Yes, he got arrested on his way here because he wanted to kill us.
And that was last
year.
Married to her husband now, Jason. She's been married to him for several years. And so this is a continual problem for these women. It's not just a getting away and, you know, and starting a new life. This is a continual problem that she deals with.
And it often involves legally changing their identity so that they can't be traced. It's very serious. There's no question about it.
If there was. I'll tell you, I grew up here. I wasn't, I didn't grow up in India. I didn't grow up in Pakistan or, any of the Middle Eastern countries. I grew up here. I grew up watching Lifetime and knowing that there is, abuse, knowing that there are shelters, but for some reason it doesn't register that I have an option to go to a woman's shelter. It didn't register, because if it would have, if I had known that I would have the support that I did end up having, I would have left him a long time ago. I didn't know that. I didn't know it in my heart. And I think that, we just need to be so active to, again, just like you said, it's twofold. It's offense and defense. Yes, we do need to be, you know, careful of who we let in into our lives, you know, into our immediate surroundings. But on the same token, we need to be able to go to these women, or these women need to be able to be comfortable. A way to reach out to these women to know that there is an option for them if they want it or when they want it. Because I, you know, my sister has been through this. I've seen women in my own mosque, you know, who cry out in the ladies' meetings, but there is not a single lady that will do anything for them. And the help that I got, you know, God placed, he was at work even when I didn't know. You know, I was just struggling in the women's shelter. And, you know, I had a boss. I was working for a home health company, and I had a boss that she prayed for me, and but she also spoke scripture to me and said, you know, Shoa, fear is not from the Lord. And that is the only scripture that I was ever told before I became a Muslim, I mean, before I became a Christian. And that has stayed with me all these years. And that is something that, you know, I hung on to when I was afraid. And she helped me get into the shelter, and then, you know, other ladies helped me get a job and get into my own apartment, and you know, a whole variety of things. And to be able to get any help from the Muslim community was laughable. I was, in fact, when I did go in, the day that I thought that I was going to go and sign the Muslim divorce decree, I was in a room with the imam, you know, with the black turban and everything, and he was sitting there, and he knew me. I mean, you know, 17 years, he knew who I was. We talked on a regular basis. But he did not even look at me, and he looked at my husband, my first husband, and said, why do you bother with this woman? Why don't you just go and get another wife? Why even bother with a divorce? So I don't even deserve that respect, you know. While there were two male witnesses, I was the only woman in there. That is their way of intimidating women into shame, you know, to shame them so that they do not do this. There were many nights when I had coworkers park outside my house because I was afraid, because my, you know, ex-husband had threatened to cut my daughter into pieces and throw her in the river. And he would call me. He would, the day he got arrested, he had called me and spoke to one of the officers in the sheriff's office in Trinity and say that today's the day you're going to die. So I handed the phone over to him, and he told that officer that, I will take care of you as well. They're just completely fearless.
And strike one, two, and three right there.
Especially our sheriff's department. Yes. Don't mess with them.
No, you don't,
mess
with them.
Don't mess with Texas.
But, you know, they got used to parking outside my house, and they would just stay there hours and hours. Just
you know, folks, another observation. You hear this, and the average Western mindset is just shocked by the barbarity and the evil that we're hearing about. And one of the factors that I was just very surprised to learn is that for 14 centuries, Muhammad initiated this. He said it was just fine for first cousins to intermarry. Mm-hmm. But we all know what happens when close generations are allowed to intermarry over a period of time. It literally causes brain damage.
Yeah, they become Democrats.
You have millions, hundreds of millions of people from the Middle East over 14 centuries intermarrying. We've got a real problem on our hands. It's evil, it's barbaric, and it's also a huge dilemma of the human body, of biological depravity over 14 centuries of intermarrying.
Well, Kelly, there's right. another part of the equation that we need to emphasize more. You know, one part of it is exposing the evil of Islam, and the other part of the equation is we need to present the fact that the Christian faith teaches husbands, commands husbands, to love their wives so much that they would die for them.
Absolutely. That's a great point, Bill. The contrast could not be greater. And we're looking at the difference between pure evil and that which is good. And folks, we have to choose good. And we have to, the only mindset that the Islamic world understands is a position of strength. If we try to sit down at the negotiating table, they just laugh at us behind our backs. We have to give them a position of strength. And it's just that simple. And that's why it's so sad to watch our so-called president and our so-called secretary of state wringing their hands trying to negotiate a good deal while the Iranians are just laughing at us.
They are. Well, what America needs to see is Christians coming out from behind their church doors, going right into the public square and courageously declaring these things in the public square. You know, a silent Christian is a defeated Christian, and we have been so intimidated by being called names like Islamophobe or homophobe that we have retreated from our own culture. We were chased out of our culture like a housewife chases mice with a broom. We've retreated like mice when we should be roaring like lions.
You know, I read a Winston Churchill quote yesterday. I'm paraphrasing, but he said, "A man without enemies is essentially worthless."
I remember one of his quotes. He said, "You have enemies? Good. It means you've stood for something in your life."
Yeah, that was it.
Okay. Yeah, one of my favorites.
Hey, guys, I've got to sign off. It's been a delight. And Shoa, bless you. And I'll be praying for you and your family and your safety. And Bill, you're right. The church has got to wake up to this problem, and they've got to get the word out that they have resources available to help these women escape. And it's got to happen.
And it's not going to be the government that is willing to do it. It has to be the Christian church. They're the only ones with the courage to stand firm.
And the moral authority. Yep.
And the moral authority. Good point.
Yep. Thanks, everybody. I'm going to take off, but bless you all.
Thank you, Kelly. Thank you for being
Thank
here.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
I do have a question that, that was typed into the little chat box here a minute ago. How do we reach these women? How do we get the message to the average Muslim woman who has got a lump in her throat, walks around with tears in her eyes, abused, has no freedom, and whose kids, you know, are told that they have, you know, she has to mind them? How do you reach these women?
Well, I tell you, these women are hard to find, only because, well, number one, because of the essential shame of domestic abuse. You know, women don't want to admit that the man they married, perhaps the man they love, even if it's an arranged marriage. There are lots of arranged marriages that, you know, develop and flourish and, you know, where the husband and wife love each other.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the woman in that marriage has accepted her place.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but not all marriages are like that, and for a woman to admit that her marriage has failed is a very difficult thing. So it's hard. Not only is it hard in that sense, but it is also hard because these cultures are so close. And you have to, I believe that you really have to put yourself in a position where you can offer them, I mean, like so many missionaries do, as far as English as a second language, perhaps refugee services, medical services. these are the venues through which we can reach them.
Something that will draw them out.
Well, certainly because they need an excuse to leave the house. Otherwise, they generally do not leave the house.
And you're certainly not going to get help in the mosque and among the other women.
No, you won't, unless you're offering a service of some kind.
Right.
So, you know, it is that. And, we need to remember that God is awakening Muslims through dreams, through visions, and through the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit goes where we cannot go.
Right.
And all of us have been called to go, whether it's in the United States, whether it is, across our borders. Every Christian has been called to go and preach the gospel of Christ. And we need to do that. This is how we will reach the Muslim world, and this is how they will hear. But in order to soften their hearts, I believe that, you know, the Holy Spirit goes and softens their heart and reaches them through visions and dreams, because Muslims put a heavy stock in visions, in dreams, and that is how I got my start to Christianity, because I can remember dreams as young as probably 5 or 6, and I would get this this dream of a figure in white, and it would happen again and again and again, and it's not always the same dream, but it's the same person, and you know that it's the same person. And my dream was, the doors opened, and this was before I was even a Christian, that the doors opened, and it was like the heavens, and now I realize, of course, it was Jesus, and Jesus opened his hands, and my name was engraved in his hands.
Mm.
Well, it was very powerful, and it certainly left an impression, and I carried it with me, and I carried so many dreams and visions like this. Now, there's a difference, of course, between dreams and visions. It's very hard to explain, but they're very compelling, and they're very compelling to Muslims because Muslims, they're very open to that. So it is probably easier than an open physical door. So we need to not only go physically, but we need to pray for the softening of their heart, because I'm a living example, and the experiences I have, I know how God just showed me how God can change people's hearts.
Today I was reading an article, I don't know what it was in, but anyway, I saw it on Facebook, and I followed it out. And it was an ISIS soldier that had I think he'd been shot, and he died. And he was taken to hell. He said, I think Allah took him to hell. But he came back talking about Jesus.
Yes.
And, and I know that I understand, and I've heard from many people that God is using the supernatural. You know, we live in a world that really has a hard time differentiating between the natural, the supernatural, the temporal, the spiritual, and they want to believe in God, but they'll talk about hell, or they don't want to believe in hell, but they'll talk about this or that, and they only believe in what they want to believe when they need to believe in it, and so it's mind blowing the way God will use the supernatural, or God will use the spiritual to draw. And to pull back that veil, because the veil that we live in this world, the temporal world, that's all we touch it, it's real. But the reality is we touch it and it's temporal, it's temporary.
Exactly.
The real is the spiritual, and that's what God is doing. He's pulling that curtain back, and he's using that to reach into the hearts of some of these people. And I just was asked a minute ago, about how can you reach these ladies, these women in stores and in malls, and it's probably not a real a lot of possibility in there.
No, it's not easy. And I tell you that, you know, many times I would frown if I see, you know, women smile at me or whatever. Because, you know, as a Muslim, you're taught that you're better than them and you're going to heaven and they're not, you know. And you don't experience grace as a Muslim. And when you do experience it as a Christian, there is nothing like it. And I firmly believe that if we can let Muslims experience the love and the grace that we've received, that we know and that we live with, the safety of knowing a loving God, that if they can experience that, their world will change. They will change, and we can change that.
So tell us about your children. You talked about a little bit about your divorce, a little bit about your marriage, some of the things you've gone through since. I know that you and Jason have been married how many years?
Almost 5 years.
Almost 5 years. Your kids, quite a few of them have become Christians.
Yes.
So tell us about your kids and what God is doing in their lives.
Well, I have 5 sons and 1 daughter, biological. I have 2 stepchildren. Now, my children were raised Muslim, very strict Shiite Muslim. And my daughter was, wearing the burqa by the time she was 9 years old, even before that. So it was hard initially for them to see the change that I was going through. It was very hard for them to accept that I had become a Christian. In fact, when I first got my first Bible, I hid it in my car under my seat so my boys wouldn't see it. My daughter was the only one to be there when I got baptized. I hesitated telling my children because they were boys, it's hard to break these old habits. You still treat, your boys like men when you're in a Muslim culture. And, as a Muslim mother, I really didn't have many rights as far as what I could tell the boys to do or not. Everything was their dad. I didn't have any rights to tell them anything. So it took a while for them to accept that I had become a Christian. Initially they thought that I had become a Christian just temporarily. Until later they saw the change in me. And now I am, very thankful. I have all but 2 of them are Christian.
That's wonderful.
It is.
Your daughter was saved this last year, wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
23?
Yes. She's 22.
Oh, 22.
So, yeah.
I always get her age wrong. Every time I say it, I'm like, by a year someway. But anyway, it's awesome. I mean, your children have been raised in this culture, and I know you told me how difficult it was to bring your children out and to have to answer to them because they were confused by the whole thing.
Yes.
Not just you leaving their father, but the whole religious experience. And, I mean, it's not
it
just...
was.
When you're dealing with what you dealt with, it's not just, I'm changing from becoming a Baptist to a Pentecost or becoming a Protestant to a Catholic.
No.
It's an entire culture.
Well, everything. Not only did my world fall apart as I saw it back then, it was my children's too.
Sure.
Because now they see their mother, which, in Muslim terms, if you're not wearing the burqa, you are a woman of, questionable character.
Right.
So here she, my daughter and my son, they see their mother take the burqa off. Now she's working and, she's going out. So, what they've known their whole life is, just falling apart and they don't know where to stand. I spent many years not talking to my daughter because she thought I had just gone wild. I would don't know what your mother is up to, So it took her, she did not attend my wedding to my second husband. achieve, but it took a while. Mm-hmm. And you know, she's come around. Of course, she's become a Christian. She comes mm-hmm. every time she can, and she just loves my husband. She yes. loves him. So
well,
what's
not to love?
Well, yes,
great guy.
But you know, I God places yeah. people in your life, mm-hmm. And I was really in my lowest point. I didn't even have my children with me. I had sent them to live with my aunt. You know, one for their safety, but also because I needed to be able to go to school and mm-hmm. you know earn money. And so there was a time I didn't see them, and I only had one friend. And you know, I work in the ambulance, and the friend that I had just happened to be a very strong Christian. So she, in fact, because I used to work 7 days a week, she became my mentor as a Christian. Mm-hmm. She taught me what a Christian life is and how a Christian, how a believer lives. And she would always tell me, Shola, you know, I would cry for my daughter, and she would say, you just need to pray, and God will change her heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I really learned the power of prayer through her. And through her, I understood, you know, what prayer and mm-hmm. patience and all of these wonderful things are.
Right. So how did you meet Jason?
Well, okay, so I was doing home health, mm-hmm. and my boss, of course, again, a wonderful Christian family, they sent me to, to take care of a lady, and they asked me, they said, please be very, you know, very kind to this family, take care of them because they are our pastors, and, you know, they really need your help. So I went across Houston to Missouri City, and I was thinking, I don't know why I'm doing this and who lives out here. And so I go there and I knock on the door, and lo and behold, the door opens and there's my husband standing there. I didn't know, of course, that he was going to be my husband. I couldn't stand him when I met him. But well, they turned out to be, Margot Zilch and my father-in-law, and I took care of her, and she was having some pulse surgery-ish complications. And one day, she said that we would always talk about her going to church and how active she was in church. And I told her that I would be happy to take her to church on a Sunday. So I get dressed, and my daughter is really the only person I told that, you know, okay, I'm going to be taking her. It was like a big secret from my other children that I will be taking my patient to church. So, we take her to church, and the minute I walked in there, I felt like I had stepped into home. Everything felt right.
Mm-hmm.
When everything just falls into place, and, you know, you might as well hear the angels, you know, singing or whatever. It was wonderful. It was that aha moment,
yes.
You know, when you know you've come home.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a while. I mean, there was no instant conversion, but I loved it.
Yeah.
I just loved it. And you know when you belong, you know
yeah.
that you're in the right place,
right.
And you're comfortable. And so I started going there with her. I think I used her as an excuse in
mm-hmm.
the beginning. And then I started going on my own when I was on shift. And one day, I can't really tell you when I made that decision, with the altar call, but I went there. And I think, after the services, I was thinking, oh, gosh, what did I do? I didn't realize, you know, the whole scope of what I had done. But It was wonderful. Yeah. It was wonderful. And then Jason and I, we started dating. And
so after you got saved, then he got to be better, you know, nicer.
Yeah, he got nicer eventually. He was just, I was not used to, you know, always being in the barca.
Right.
I was not used to, I guess I would say, men flirting with me. And
right.
He would just flirt with me, and he would open the door just a crack, and so I would have to squeeze through the door right next to him to get through. And I was not used to that. It
right.
would make me very uncomfortable, but of course, you know, it felt good, I guess. And, you know, we started talking.
Is he listening?
I don't know.
Well, I sent the link, so he might be. But anyway, Michael had a question. Michael, you wanna ask your question?
Yes. I know that you mentioned a while back while we were talking that you actually taught the other women in the mosque for a while, and that you really have even a deeper sense of the programming that goes on there and how it robs you of your independence and everything. Could you just lightly touch, I hate to change the direction the conversation is going right now, because we're learning so much about the freedom that you experienced from the abuse that you were under, and I don't really want to change it a lot, but can you talk about how the programming works in the mosque?
I sure can. In fact, it was a key thing for me to do that. I think God was just putting me in places for me to understand, get a better understanding, because he knew what he would use it for later. Mm-hmm. And I was very active. I think I just have that personality of just, you know, diving into whatever I do and getting really involved in it. And I loved being a Muslim. I loved it. I loved worshiping, and I loved, you know, even back then I was in charge of the kitchen in the mosque, and we cooked, you know, for Ramadan. We cooked for, like, I don't know, maybe 1,000 people a night, you know. And so we did that. We taught children Sunday school, and we had a women's group there. And you know, I was just very involved in a lot of aspects of the day-to-day running of the mosque, because in the mosque, it's like a women's section. So men and women are separated. You know, they don't congregate together in the mosque.
At all.
So, but then there has to be a woman, you know, a couple of women that will, you know, cross the border and talk to the man and, you know, get whatever needs to be done. So I was one of them, and, you know, if anybody needed anything, they would call in, and so they would say, okay, please talk to Sister Shoah, because I was one of the ladies. So everybody knew me. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew me over there. And it was always, you know, Sister Shoah, and, you know, how much they love us, and how much I was loved, and how much I was known. But, you know, when I started having second thoughts about being a Muslim, it was, I would say it was almost overnight when, you know, even my closest friends, their husbands had told them, had forbidden them to talk to me. Because they didn't want me influencing them. They didn't want their wives to be seen with me, and, you know, for people to think that, okay, well, if she's
right.
associating with her, then, you know. So it was overnight I was pretty much shunned, separated, excommunicated from my community.
Well, I want to ask a question that, and I've never asked you this before, and so I'm not sure where you're at on it, but in 1982, the Muslim Brotherhood, and I don't have the
you know, all the facts in front of me because I haven't read my own article in a while. But the Muslim Brotherhood put out a paper, a thing called the project, which was basically how they were going to take down the Northern Hemisphere, the Western Hemisphere, and the Western world, especially the United States and Canada and Mexico, and how they were going to do that in so many years and how the process.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, the big things, was using the mosque, building as many mosques as possible,
mm-hmm.
and using the mosque as a training ground, and even as in a lot of places it's militant, where they, you know, do physical training and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see any of that in the mosque as a woman? Were you exposed to any of that, or is that, you know, generally, what do you know about that?
Well, I didn't know much. Mm-hmm. All I knew was the discussions that were held in my own house. I didn't see much in the mosque, but then again, you know, women are kept separate.
Right.
So if there was anything going on in behind closed doors, we certainly were not privy to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I know the discussions, you know. I mean, it's been so many years, but I guess back then I could have probably pointed out the people I knew that were supporting financially terrorist Hezbollah, you know, terrorist groups. And I realize the big scope of it now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't back then.
Right.
I knew that it was something we had to keep quiet. I just didn't know how illegal or how
mm-hmm.
Destructive that was.
Mm-hmm.
I had an inkling, but certainly not to the point where, oh, yes, you know, we're having, you know, meetings with people that are financially backing terrorist groups.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell you now who they were, but back then, yes, there were certainly people that we knew.
Yeah. So, David, hello. Okay, David said he had a question, but anyway, I do have another question after David says his.
Mm-hmm.
We're running out of time. We're down to about 14 minutes or so mm-hmm. left, and I don't know what happened to him, but I'm going to go ahead and ask you, hang on, let's see what he's got to say. I'm going to go ahead and ask one more question. And I want to ask some questions about what we were just discussing. I've done a lot of study on the Muslim, the care of the Muslim Brotherhood, the different facets. Never to the degree that, you know, with what you know, and I know that you were raised in this, or at least many years since you were 18, you've been involved at some point, some level.
Yeah.
But the thing is, we talk about a moderate Muslim, and we talk about there's no such thing as a moderate Muslim. Now, when I look at it and when I talk to people, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I look at it as there are those who want to completely eliminate us, and they are radical. And then there are those on the other end, almost the other end of the spectrum, who are moderate in the sense that they don't want to get involved. But then there are those that go to court.
Mm-hmm.
They push Sharia law into the courts. They push the political, they push the Muslims onto city council. They put the people in places of authority and places of where they make laws. And yet these people who are on these councils and on these courts and making these laws, they're not considered radical. They're moderate. So
yeah.
Where's the spectrum on that?
There is no such thing as a moderate Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Because moderate Islam does not line up with the word of Islam, with the word of Muhammad. It just does not line up. Now, we can have Muslims, let's take my parents, for instance. They've been Muslims all their lives because that's
who they've been all their life.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they know.
And they would be moderate.
And, they would be moderate in the sense that, yes, they do believe that at the end of the world, everyone, it will be either a Muslim or will die. But I don't...
Sharon, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, good, okay.
Okay. Let her finish this one, and then we want you to ask your question.
Okay.
Okay. So as far as that, yes, they're not very active. I can never imagine my parents or, you know, other very mild-mannered Muslims who are devout Muslims as far as practicing Muslims, as far as, you know, going to the mosque and praying five times a day Muslims. But I don't believe, I believe in my heart that they would never attack, or kill anyone who's not a Muslim, but that does not mean that they do not support that idea.
So then that's the key right there, the supporting the idea, because when you read the Quran, you know, I've never read the Quran. I've read parts of the Quran. I've seen, you know, little sketches, just like, you know, and the thing is, it's not a real peaceful book of love and, you know, make you want to go to sleep and lay your head on the pillow and just rest.
Oh, no.
There's a lot of blood, a lot of violence, a lot of stuff going on in there that tells the people. One thing about God, people say that he was violent, you know, and in the Old Testament there was a lot of violence. However, he did not tell and does not tell us as a culture now to go out and do these things. We are to turn the other cheek. We are to love our enemy. Where the Quran is a completely different book. And so how can a person follow the Quran and the teachings of the Quran and still be a moderate Muslim and see the good in it? I mean, and not see, you know, that, I don't know, I guess if that's all you've known, then, you know.
Well, you know, if you look geographically, a lot of these Muslims come from cultures where, you know, you have lots of gods, lots of masters, lots of gods. So, you know, according to them, they are worshiping one God.
Mm-hmm.
And I call these moderate Muslims a lot of Muslims in waiting. Because they're just waiting to either die and perhaps go to heaven. They're waiting for the end of the world. They're waiting for the Mahdi to come and, provide justice for all the Muslims and provide world peace, which according to them, it will happen. But, what they choose to ignore is that eventually they will have to choose a side.
Right.
They can't sit on the fence anymore. So they will have to, you know, Islam requires them to choose a side, and that's the decision they're going to have to make. And whether, you know, I think that they're afraid of making that because a lot of them, this violence, this abuse does not make sense, and in their heart, they're not totally convinced of it, yet they're just too comfortable where they are to do anything else.
Right.
They're afraid of alienating their families.
I'm going to chime in for a second on that, if I may, Shoa. It seems to me that, and this is something that, if Kelly were on the phone, I think if we're still on the call, he would certainly concur with. This is just a rabbit trail because I do have another question I want to ask you. We're running out of time. But the main thing I want to point out there is during World War II, and I'm sure you've heard this before, the majority of Germans were not Nazis. They did not like what the Nazis were doing, but they didn't do anything to stop them, and they therefore became irrelevant. And it seems to me that and I do believe that the vast majority of Muslims are not radicalized of the type that would want to commit violent jihad against anybody. The lowest number I've ever heard is 7%. The highest number I've ever heard is 25% that would. When you translate those percentages into hard numbers, they're staggering. 7% of worldwide Islam represents 93 million people. But the point I'm trying to make there is if between 93% and 75% of Muslims are not radicalized to commit violent jihad, and they don't stop those that would. They become just like the vast majority of Germans, and they become irrelevant. Would you not agree with that?
I totally do. And, you know, they're happy to stand, and, you know, they might just shake their head and turn away when they see what's going on. But essentially, they do agree because that is what their God asks them to. You know, the Muslim God asks for total submission. That is what Muslim That's, means. You have completely submitted.
Islam means submission, yes.
Yes. So,
I have one question. I don't mean to cut you short there, but we're down to the wire. And I wanted to go back to something that we had talked about for a minute, we had touched on a little while ago. Muslim women in the supermarket, in the Walmart, on the street, in the bus, wherever, she may and may not be scared to death, but I'm told by more than one source, and I'd like you to verify or say, no, that's not true, that even if she wants to, she cannot speak to a man. I could never approach that Muslim woman in the burqa and say, you know, and talk to her about Jesus, whereas a woman, Sharon, might be able to approach her. Am I right on that, or is that not completely true?
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, places like the United States and maybe some modern, maybe Egypt, maybe Turkey, where you can actually approach, a man can approach a woman. But believe me, there will be hundreds of eyes on that woman and lots of questions as to what did that guy want. So it's not something that's done. Certainly not something that's
done. And she's in grave danger.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, see, that's something
I mean, I
was going to say, I'm very cautious of that because I've seen Muslim women and I'm afraid to talk to them because I don't want them to get hurt because of something that I, you know, innocently did or said. I would be like, no, I can't. Oh. I don't know how to broach that.
Absolutely. When I first started working, when I got into the general workforce, I used to have, you know, coworkers tell me, you know, when I first joined, I would actually walk with my head down and I never made eye contact. I didn't realize that until someone told me that. Mm-hmm. But you just don't, you know, as a Muslim woman, you don't make eye contact and you usually walk, you know, slow, with your head down. So that's, even in the United States, that's how women live.
Hmm. Well, I got to tell you what, Sheryl, we are running out of time drastically. I do want to take a few minutes, and I want to say that I'm going to give you the final word on the show, which is going to happen in about a minute and a half. I want to take a moment, and I can't express how thankful I am that you've taken the time out of your schedule to be with us tonight. It means a lot. You've been a blessing. I've been praying for you, and I know a lot of our listeners that were aware that you were going to be on the show tonight have also been praying for you and your continued strength and your continued ministry. And I'm going to say good night for right now because we are running out of time, and I would like you to please just take a minute and offer whatever God has put on your heart to our listeners right now for moving forward with this, if you would.
Absolutely, David. I thank you so much. And I've been so honored to be a part of this tonight. You know, our approach as Christians, as Americans, should be in several different ways. Of course, we need to defend our home and be watchful as to what comes into our home and who we interact with as our families. But as Christians, we are called to go out, and we are called to preach the Word of God. And, you know, we do have to pray and ask God to give us the wisdom as to where we draw the line between, you know, a concerned and aware American citizen, and also the humanity of our Christian faith. And you know, how best to and keep ourselves protected, but to be bold enough to go and preach the gospel of Christ. And that is only something that the Holy Spirit can give us, and it is through prayer.
Amen. Thank you so much, Stella, for being with us tonight. And thank you to our audience for being here and for staying with us. And we'll have this online so you can listen to it again if you want to. Download it. Share it with your friends. Because I'm going to tell you something. This is worth getting out. People need to know what was spoken tonight. They need to hear Stella's message. So if you've got somebody that you think can use this message, put it on a disc and give it to them. God bless. David, Michael, I love you guys. Thank you so much.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, Gina Clinton.